of House State Affairs to order. It's 8:07, and it's February 23rd. And present are Representative Ramirez, Representative Grunberg, Representative Gatto, Representative Gardner, and Representative Seaton. And today, we have a lot of work to do today. First thing I would like to do is, if you've got a schedule, I'm going to change the order of business so that we can introduce a CS for House Bill 475, which is public and teacher retirement system, so that the people that are here for that bill will have a copy, but we won't be taking up discussions of that today. So, Representative Gatto?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll move CS for House Bill 475, version G.
Thank you. So we have before us version G, and that'll be available as the work draft the committee will be working on. But we're not going to deal with that today. We'll deal with that in detail at our next meeting. If anyone in the public or any members have any other technical amendments, just so everybody understands that retirement bill, these are technical amendments, and they're all meant to be consistent with the policies that we adopted last year. And so if anyone has any other technical changes or clarifications they want to make to 141, not policy changes, but technical changes, please go ahead and get those to us. And so anyway, that's where we'll be. And so we'll take that up to the next meeting. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Will we be getting a sectional analysis?
Yes,
475?
We will.
Thank you.
We will be getting a sectional. However, this this bill is a series of basically clarification amendments to, so each one of those sections is basically an entire entire clarification to something that was unclear in House Bill or Senate Bill 141. And the reason we are looking at this is, if we don't clarify these things, then it's going to be left up to the administrator of the plan to make judgments. And if they make judgments without legislative direction, they may or may not be consistent with the policies that we adopted in our discussions last year. And so this will make that clarification from the legislature of what our intent in those provisions was, instead of leaving it up to the administrator to try and guess what our intent was when there were, you know, citation conflicts, or something was included in one section, like under the TERS, and the language didn't get changed in PERS or police fire, so that makes them all consistent. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the reasons that happened so much is because we never did get a sectional analysis for 141.
Right, and we will we are going to get a sectional analysis, and it's not only going to be a sectional analysis, but each section will explain, it'll be a little different than just the normal. It'll explain what it's going to do, and what the positives and negatives, and what are the consequences if we don't do it. So that's what we intend to have in the sectional. Are there any other questions on House Bill 475? Seeing none, we'll put that aside, and we'll take that up at our next meeting. And I wanted to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Lynn. So our first bill is House Bill 403, Neighborhood Electric Vehicles. Representative Gatto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce CS for House Bill 403, version F.
Okay, we have a motion to bring version F, CS for 403, version F, before the committee. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we have version 403, and we have the sponsor's substitute here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sponsor substitute Ian Fisk, here for Representative Thomas. I will explain the changes the CS makes kind of as I go through the bill. But the first and most significant one is that it changes the designation of neighborhood electric vehicles to low-speed vehicles. and that would bring this bill into line with the existing federal regulations that govern these types of vehicles. But first of all, let me just make a distinction here. We're not talking about golf carts and meter-maid vehicles, although these could probably be used in those applications. Low-speed vehicles are defined by federal law as vehicles that have four wheels. They have to be capable of a minimum of 20 miles per hour, but they're limited to a maximum of 25 miles an hour. And any kind of modifications to make them go faster than that are prohibited. So, you know, you can't put a nitro pack on these things and turn them into drag racers or anything like that. They're required by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration to have headlights, front and rear turn signals, tail lights, brake lights, reflectors, automotive quality windshields, mirrors, parking brakes, vehicle identification numbers, seat belts, and they have to meet certain testing requirements that are spelled out in the federal regs. Those regs were developed in 1998, and these types of vehicles are now legal in 36 other states. And low-speed vehicles offer several advantages that could be as useful in Alaska as they are elsewhere, and those include fuel efficiency, zero emissions, or at least significantly lower emissions. They're popular with retired folks, and also they offer accessibility for those that have physical disabilities. The problem that we have right now, though, is that in Alaska, the DMV cannot register or regulate these vehicles, and they support this legislation, DMV does, and they ask for the specific authority to do so, to register and regulate these. In addition to the change that I mentioned earlier in this CS designation from neighborhood electric vehicles to low-speed vehicles, the other difference is the drafter decided to spell out that the registration fees in Section 2 would be $100 biannually, just like they are for any other passenger vehicle. So in summary, these vehicles offer us an opportunity to basically legitimize in Alaska a way of getting around that's more efficient, and in light of the fact that the President mentioned our addiction to oil, why shouldn't we take a small step like this to get things move in a different direction? They're not going to revolutionize transportation here overnight, but we should allow DMV to do what they want to do and regulate and register these vehicles. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and be open for questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm kind of unfamiliar with these vehicles, so I have to sort of figure out in my own mind that I understand what they are. Are they what people call Segways?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, no. Segways are I believe, referred to in statute as personal electric vehicles, and those would not be meeting these requirements. Segways have, I've never actually ridden one, but they're like two-wheeled vehicles that you get on, and they don't have to meet any of these requirements.
And to follow up with that question, on page 2 of the bill, lines 20, I think that'll answer some of the questions. It's low-speed vehicles means an electric motor vehicle that has four wheels, unladen weight of 1,800 pounds or less, and was manufactured, capable of self-propelling. And in the first section is a requirement that they meet all the safety standards. Representative Gardner, and then Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So in follow-up, they're essentially treated like a car, and people would have to have a driver's license to have them on the city street, and they'd have to have license and title and all of that. Would we then require that the dealers process license and title fees the same way we do with auto vehicles?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's a good question. I would presume so, because, I think your initial statement was correct. They would be essentially like other cars. Section 1 would, basically says that, that's actually in Section 3. The operator is subject to all these other applicable traffic and other laws. I would presume that dealers would be as well.
Okay, and?
Yeah, and we have DMV online, and we can ask them that question.
And then one final question related.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What about sound? I've heard people whizzing around the neighborhoods on some kind of vehicles. I don't know what you call them, but they sound like a lawnmower, and they're really obnoxious. Do these vehicles Are they quieter, noisier, the same?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the vast majority of low-speed vehicles are electric vehicles, and they seem to be the most popular with the general public. And yeah, they're not like lawnmowers. I think they'll let you sleep in the morning if they go by your house.
Okay, thank you.
And I just want to check where this bill limits these vehicles by definition to being electric vehicles. They cannot be the small engine vehicles. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. As it's written now, it says a low-speed vehicle means an electric motor vehicle. I have to tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I had a misunderstanding with our drafter yesterday, and I take responsibility up for it. When I asked him to change the designation from neighborhood electric vehicle to low-speed vehicle to basically to bring this in compliance with all the other states and federal laws, I forgot to ask him to delete the word electric on page 2, line 20. Because there are some vehicles that could be developed that would meet these other speed restrictions and so on that could be powered by propane or other things. We don't necessarily want to limit the industry to only focusing on electric vehicles. However, the vast majority of them are. If you'll see, I think I included in your packet some photographs of some of these vehicles just so you can visualize what they are, and those are all electric vehicles.
Cute.
But the point of these is they're filling a market that is asking for an energy-efficient type of vehicle. They are, because they're limited in speed, they're going to be limited in most likely in sound. I mean, you're not going to see people cruising around on lawnmowers, as the other representative mentioned earlier.
I think I want to anticipate a question Representative Gardner was going to ask. Where do you buy these things?
We've got, yeah, Representative Gardner is next.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If a vehicle has a maximum speed of 25, doesn't it automatically pass the requirement for a minimum speed of 20?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gatto, I think that the reason they put the minimum speed in is that they wanted them to have at least a certain amount of power to accelerate at times when that might be necessary. And they didn't, you know, in designing these regs back in 98 when the feds came up with them, I think the point was that they should be able to go at least a decent enough speed that they're not going to even back up traffic on a relatively, you know, on a neighborhood street. So the idea was to design something that would be that would fit well with the speed limits in most neighborhoods.
Well, I agree, but if it can go 25, it can go 20, or 15, or 10, or 0. Am I right?
Well, yes, Representative Gatto, you're correct.
I think that Representative Gatto, if you look at the definition there, it says and has a maximum speed. Mm-hmm. In other words, it can't be a vehicle that can go 30 miles an hour.
Right.
It has to be limited, but that doesn't mean that it has any minimum. You could have something that had a 5 mile an hour, you know, you could have a powered electric wheelchair that would go 5 miles an hour, couldn't go over 25 miles an hour, but wouldn't be licensed to be out on the street in traffic, and I think that's the point. Representative, did you have a follow-up?
No.
Okay. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want us to eliminate the word electric on line 20 of page 2?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg.
Okay, I'd move amendment number 1. Object.
Okay, and we're not ready for amendments yet. We haven't had public testimony.
Oh, okay.
But we have noticed that you're going to consider that. Did you have further questions?
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
And this is, I noticed Mr. Ritchie was here a minute ago, and I was going to ask him, hopefully he would listen to this, but I'll ask you. In Section 3B, where it talks about the speed limits, I notice on the Douglas Highway, parts of that are 40 miles an hour, parts of it are 30 miles an hour, and the same road can have various speed limits. The setting of speed limits in this sort of thing is traditionally a local function, and putting it in a state law makes it the hardest to change. How would you feel about, in Section B, stating and this is just a general idea, but stating that if we need to, where these can be driven should be left up to the, either if it's a state road, the Department of Transportation, whoever sets this, or the local authorities. I don't think we should be putting this kind of detail in state law. What do you think?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think that's a good point. I think that the most important thing here is that we allow the Department of Motor Vehicles to register these, you know, this type of vehicle, and we kind of get the ball rolling. But I think other states have chosen to do something similar to that. Let state register and let municipalities determine, you know. But I think one of the concerns is maybe you don't want to set up too much of a patchwork of different regulations. If municipalities were allowed the latitude to figure out which particular areas within the town they could designate as low-speed vehicle areas, I don't think the sponsor would have any issue with that. But I think we'd have to be careful not to, you know, they're going to have to meet the federal requirements for these vehicles anyway.
Sure.
So it's not like you're going to have, you know, modified vehicles in every town. So it would probably be a
Yeah, I'm only talking about the speed limits. I'm not talking about the specifications for the vehicles. And I'm not sure how, we have the two co-chairs of the Transportation Committee on this committee, and it goes to Transportation next. I don't know what the chair's intention is, but I that concept and how we do it in this bill, I don't know, but we can talk about that.
Mr. Fisk, on that point, if we, the reason that there's a minimum speed on these vehicles is to keep them within some kind of a flow of traffic for safety reasons, and if a local governmental didn't set that you couldn't go on a 55-mile-an-hour road, wouldn't we be, you know, anticipating creating a very dangerous system by having something that has a maximum speed of 25 miles operating on a 45 or 55-mile-an-hour road? I thought that that was part of the point of...
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good point, and I think I'm looking up what the California statute said, but, I mean, I think you... making a general designation like that, you know, about their, you know, not allowing them to be used on a roadway of over 35 miles an hour, not being able to cross a roadway that has a higher speed limit, or being able to cross a roadway with a higher speed limit, but only if it's the ending of the crossing ends up on another road that has the appropriate 35-mile-an-hour limit. I think those things would be good, but I think maybe working, allowing municipalities to make, you know, certain local, if they feel like one intersection, for instance, is too dangerous to allow these vehicles to be used on, that might not be a bad option. So a certain amount of latitude, but I think it would be very important not to give municipalities the idea that it'd be okay to drive one down Egan Drive, for instance, you'd have massive, you know, traffic snarl-ups, and that wasn't the intention of the federal law to allow them on a regular highway.
And we do have the Alaska State Troopers online, so we'll ask them that question as well as to and DMV, whether that would change their opinion on the licensing of these vehicles. So,
if I might, real quick, yep. Mr. Chairman, this bill is going to pick up a fiscal note, which I have not received yet, and it's going to be a relatively small one, like $10,000 for licensing, development, that kind of thing, programming. So it's going to get a finance referral. It's already got a Transportation Committee referral just for the members.
Yeah, we do have a fiscal note.
Oh, you do have it. Okay. Well, I'm glad you have it. I haven't seen it yet.
Representative Rammer.
Just heard about it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. First of all, I applaud the notion. I'm familiar with the introduction of low-speed vehicles in California, and have seen them used in Palm Spring, Palm Desert, which is not a very densely populated area relative to Santa Monica, where I have also seen them used, employed, and it's very successful, and it's much less expensive, and seem to reduce traffic congestion. So I applaud you for this effort. I will ask you to address one issue for me, please. The sponsor, Representative Thomas, comes from a warmer part of the state of Alaska, a more mild part of the state of Alaska.
Less frigid.
Permit?
Less frigid.
Yes, less frigid, thanks.
Any place but Fairbanks.
Representative Rammer.
On the record, Representative Lynn, I will be delighted to correct you. Fairbanks is a It's a wonderful community. But it faces certain unique climactic challenges. I spent $15,000 on two golf carts for my private sector job 2 years ago. And in doing my due diligence and exploring them, I was unable to purchase electric motor vehicles because in a colder climate, you are required to remove all the batteries and store them in a warm weather setting in a garage or a heated space throughout the winter. Otherwise, they freeze and you lose all their value. They're heavy, they're toxic, they're a pain to deal with. And so we had to pay extra to get two gas-powered vehicles. These were, you know, golf carts, but it's a very similar vehicle. And since this is going to be licensed by the DMV, I would want something that can be used universally across the state of Alaska. This is not an appropriate application for the interior or any northern region. So our chairman has a habit of kind of allowing us to be pensive when we consider these bills. And I support the notion, but I'd like to see some sort of a caveat so that the interior or any northern communities where this is just as applicable. I know out in Savunga, for instance, you know, they call any ATV a Honda, you know, kind of like a box of Kleenex. No matter what it is, it's a Honda. And so the notion of a legal low-speed vehicle is exceptional. I just would like to see an application that works across the whole state of Alaska and not just the warmer climb. So if we can address that, I'm thrilled with good public policy, less expensive. These vehicles are sometimes only $8,000 to get a safe vehicle, so it's just wonderful. But I want to make sure that we can have one in Fairbanks that's street legal, and the way that this bill is presently drafted can't do that because you can't have the exposure of then trying to warm weather store your vehicle. So if you can help us address that, I'd be pleased.
Through the chair, thanks for your comments, Representative Ramirez. Of course, did work fine in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
but obviously, this was part of, I think, why it was important to change the designation from neighborhood electric vehicles to low-speed vehicles, because as the industry sees, you know, the need for vehicles such as this that would be more of an all-season, a vehicle able to deal with the extremes of climate that you have in your hometown and others, you know, in the northern states, they'll probably want to develop other technology that would allow them to meet the speed requirements and other safety requirements, but maybe have a different type of propulsion than batteries that don't work so well for you. So I think the CS that we have would do that.
Great. Are there any other questions? Representative Gardner.
A little bit on the humorous side, but half serious. And do they come with four-wheel drive, and how do they do on uphills?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. Well, that was one of the questions I asked. You know, I wonder if they have a four-wheel drive dually flatbed version or something that Alaskans might, you know, really like. But there are no four-wheel drive versions right now. There are actually small trucks, if you could call them that help people to take their groceries home, etc. But as far as their performance on hills, I couldn't really speak to that. I haven't driven one of these, and I'm not sure how they would do on hills. But, you know, I think that they're not necessarily only designed for flatlands. So.
And we might have some entrepreneurial Alaskans develop one. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Fitz, have you looked at all the other state laws really closely when you drafted this? Is this modeled on anyone? Any features of any other state laws that you'd like to bring up? Let me tell you what, just a thought I had. This is very specific, and I assume it has to be specific because these vehicles are defined like in federal law, something like that. Are there any other features that other state laws have that you consider or didn't consider?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there are 36 states that have registered them or made them legal. And no, I couldn't say that I've read all of their statutes. There's a few in this that were provided by a gentleman who's interested in this concept.
Mm-hmm. The man from Skagway?
Yeah, and I looked through a few of them, just scanning them. I think that the drafters did look over the, primarily what the intent was to bring them in line with the federal regulations, because that's what the other states have done. As I said, I know California did write in some language, speaking to your earlier point about allowing some latitude to municipalities.
Oh, so you have that language?
Yeah, I do, right here.
Yeah, well, we could take a look at that, because I'd like to see that.
Okay.
Seeing no further questions, so let's go to Dwayne Bannock. Are you online?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Good morning, Dwayne. Do you have the CS version F?
Regretfully, sir, I do not.
Okay.
I think I might know what's on it, though.
Well, it makes a few changes. One, it does specify for $100, let's see, it on the registration fees and sets some commercial limits and, well, if you don't have this, that's hard for you to comment on. But would you go ahead and give us your opinions on this right now anyway? I'm sure you're very familiar with what the intent of the law was.
Indeed. Very briefly, good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dwayne Bannock. I'm representing the Department of Administration, the Division of Motor Vehicles. We do support this bill. We support this bill because it has been a longstanding position of the Division of Motor Vehicles, one supported by this director, that vehicles that are somehow branded by the federal government as being a different type of motor vehicle is not covered currently under Alaska state statutes. Because we don't like to say no, this is one way that we can play a little bit of catch-up. So modifying the statutes ever so slightly. A lot of your debate earlier this morning has centered around the usage of the product itself. I would respectfully defer those questions, perhaps to my counterpart, who I understand is on the telephone line from the Department of Public Safety, as the Division of Motor Vehicles really doesn't involve ourselves in the usage of the product, but we are limited in this specific case to the titling and registration of it. One of the reasons that we brought this issue or involved ourselves in this issue, one of the brands that is very specific or very popular in this field, Global Electric Motor Cars, GEM, GEM Cars, I'm looking at a copy of their manufacturer's certificate of origin. A manufacturer's certificate of origin, or a manufacturer's statement of origin, as they may be called, MSO, MCO, is a document that comes with every brand new automobile, every brand new snowmobile, etc. And on the GEM cars specifically is some language that reads, I'll just read it, this low-speed vehicle conforms to federal regulations under Title 49, CFR, Part 571.500. It is our opinion that this statute, or this bill, will allow our statutes to then respect that this MSO is now a welcome MSO at the DMV, no different than an MSO for a Ford Mustang or something like that. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments. If there are any questions, I'd be more than willing to answer them.
Okay, and I guess the only thing on DMV is it's adding under Section 2 there a biennial registration fee for, it's adding after a passenger vehicle, a low-speed vehicle or motorhome, that's the current language, or motorhome, just adds a low-speed vehicle for the $100 per every 2 years. So is that does DMV have any problem with that addition?
No, sir, we concur with that entirely.
Okay. And DMV doesn't have any problems with removing electric from the designation, so that it would be a low-speed vehicle means a motor vehicle that has four wheels and et cetera?
Correct, sir. We concur with that amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gardner has a question for you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Bannock.
Good morning, ma'am.
I can envision this as a wonderful new business opportunity for somebody, possibly current automobile dealers, but also maybe people that carry Hondas and ATVs or boats or other kinds of leisure and entertainment activities. Would you anticipate that in terms of licensing and registration, these vehicles would be treated in the same way cars are, that the dealer would be responsible, even if the dealer is not an automobile dealer under normal circumstances?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, if it was a dealer transaction, yes.
Mr. Bannock, is there any designation of a dealer? I mean, is someone that sells four-wheelers or snow machines, are they under the same definition, you know, under their business license as a dealer?
Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty sure no. The dealer section of our Alaska statutes is specific to motor vehicles. What this bill is attempting to do is just take this low-speed vehicle and put it into the same category as vehicle.
Okay.
Thus, in anticipation perhaps of where you're going here, if you wanted to have Representative Seaton's LSV sales, I would concur that that would be a dealership under state of Alaska laws.
Okay, so if I guess I kind of missed there. If somebody wanted to sell these and they currently deal in Hondas and four-wheelers, those kind of things, would they be prevented from selling these, or would they be able to sell these?
Well, since you used Honda, let me just follow on that example. That's an excellent example. Honda, let's forget about Honda cars for just a second. Honda sells motorcycles, they sell snowblowers, they sell lawnmowers, and they sell four-wheelers. In Alaska, motorcycle dealers are also a type of automobile dealer. They're a different type of automobile dealer, but they are an automobile dealer. So if you were the Honda dealer and you sold the arrangement between four-wheelers and lawnmowers, the fact that you sold motorcycles would require you to be a automobile dealer of motorcycles in Alaska.
Okay. And if not, let's say you did not sell motorcycles, you just sold all the other kinds of snowmobiles and all, would you then have to become an automobile dealer in order to be able to sell these low-speed electric vehicles?
Yes.
Okay. And then when you became the dealer, then you would be required to do the title and registration, and that would still, you wouldn't have to be a business partner. You could still take the information and send that information into the DMV. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. That's my question. Representative Gruenberg, then Gatto.
Mr. Bannock, just for the record, you were using a number of acronyms. You used the acronym MSO. What's that?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, forgive me. MSO, abbreviation for Manufacturer's Statement of Origin. That same document is oftentimes referred to as a Manufacturer's Certificate of Origin, or MCO.
Okay. My other question is, we have, and do you have a copy of the original bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The language basically I'm looking at is Section 3 of the original bill, which is Section 4 of the CS, and it's basically the same except that it changes the term neighborhood electric vehicle to low-speed vehicle, but for our purposes, the rest of it's the same. You were referencing a federal CFR, and I didn't copy down all the numbers. But my question is whether there would be any advantage that you see, rather than listing all of these things out in the state law, of simply referencing that federal law, because as things, you know, progress, they may change the specs, and they don't, whether we should have to come back to the legislature each time. But if we simply reference, say, that low-speed vehicle shall have the definition of, quote, low-speed vehicle or whatever it is in the federal law as defined in umpty-ump CFR umpty-ump.
Mr. Grunberg, through the chair, with a smile on my face, I would tell you, great minds think alike. I think that there's some serious merit to that idea.
Yeah, I'll talk to, I see the bill sponsors substitute nodding and smiling too, so we'll deal with that too. I'm not sure how we do each of these things are very technical. Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks. Dwayne, has the department ever been contacted with reference to taking the typical everyday that you see four-wheeler out of the ditches and onto the highway as long as they could meet the turn signal and lighting, et cetera, requirements?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, yes, we have. I would share with you, I do not believe that this bill addresses that situation, though, nor would I be supporting that proposal.
Okay. There was some input from individuals who said that would be a great idea. I could then go to work, essentially do the same thing that this low-speed vehicle is doing, but do it on a four-wheeler that only costs $6,000 instead of $15,000. And so the department opposes that, is what you're telling me. What is, just in a sentence, what is the opposition?
Thank you, Representative. Through the chair, I did not bring it with me this morning. Perhaps I should have. I own a relatively new Honda four-wheeler. I have a manufacturer statement of origin. On my manufacturer statement of origin is a brand that reads, I'll do my best to paraphrase what it says, not for use on any roads or highways, specifically designed for off-road use. Your Division of Motor Vehicles banks a tremendous amount on what the manufacturer's recommendation of a particular product is. Thus, while theoretically I could take my Honda four-wheeler and put a blinkers on it and mirrors or whatever it is that the Department of Public Safety requires, the manufacturer still says this vehicle was never designed or built to be in competition with other vehicles going even 35 miles an hour.
Any other questions for Mr. Bannock?
Neither is the electric.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bannock. We also have online Representative of the Alaska State Troopers and a Global Tech, I think it is, manufacturer. They've all indicated just for questions. Does anyone have any questions for the troopers? I guess we did, Lieutenant Helgo?
Through the chair, it's Lieutenant James Helgo. Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Thanks. You heard our discussion earlier about the operation of these on limiting the operation of these vehicles to roads that have less than 35-mile-an-hour speed limits. Can you give us your input on whether you agree with that or whether you think we should change that to a local option or what your considerations would be on that?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, the dangers of commingling this type of vehicle, these vehicles are smaller. They're not built to withstand significant impact. And although they may be the correct vehicle for certain areas, in the neighborhood, at a campus setting, where there is a low traffic density, that's great. But to commingle this type of vehicle, say in downtown Fairbanks or downtown Anchorage, would be dangerous. And then given the climactic factors, or climate factors, as I look out the window here in Anchorage, it's about 17 degrees. The roads are icy. And, so I certainly agree that this type of low-speed electric vehicle should be governed by the local municipalities on where they deem it necessary and appropriate to allow these vehicles to operate.
Yeah, I guess I didn't quite get your answer to that. So do you favor the limitation that's currently in the proposed legislation that these may not be operated on a highway that has a maximum speed of more than 35 miles an hour, or are you saying that we should eliminate that and let the municipalities determine if they want to let them on higher speed roads?
No, sir. I agree that they should not be allowed on roadways that have a speed limit above 35.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else have a question for the troopers? Yes, Representative Gatto and then Grunberg.
Yes, thanks, sir. There are roadways, I think something, you could almost say trunk road in the valley, which has 45-mile-an-hour speeds, but there are some that adjoin them that have 35-mile-an-hour speeds, but they change. You can go from 35 to 45 to 55 in just a few hundred yards. If they're allowed on a 35-mile-an-hour highway, I mean, I still feel they're mixing with the heavies. And so they probably are a hazard to the heavies because you see them on the road and I would guess you'd be startled and maybe cause an accident in trying to pass them or so. Do you see that as a very significant problem, or your guess is that we can learn to live with it?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I certainly see that as a concern in the areas such as the Palmer-Wasilla area, Trunk Road area, and some of the outlying areas within the state of Alaska. If these vehicles were allowed to commingle with larger full-size vehicles and commercial vehicles, even in the areas of 35 miles per hour, that's a concern. And you are exactly correct that some of these speed limits do change in certain areas.
Just to follow up, but it doesn't matter if a road changes speed or not. I mean, if you're on a road that has a posted speed limit of 45 or 55, it would be illegal to operate that on the road, and hopefully if it's a neighborhood vehicle, you're going to know where your roads are above 35 miles an hour, because my understanding, the way this is written, is if you're in an area that has a speed limit above 35, you would not legally be able to operate that vehicle there. So just, is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay, thanks. Representative Gruenberg?
Lieutenant. My concern here, and it's more of a question, is that there are various kinds of roadways around, and I don't know if you're familiar, like with the Douglas Highway. Some of these areas have bike paths or something like that where it could be available so that the person on this little vehicle could go off to the side or whatever, and bikes use them, etc. My question was, should we have in the state law the language that says you can't have them on a road more than 35, or should we provide some flexibility either to the, I don't know, is it the Department of Transportation who sets the speed limits on state roads, or to the municipalities so they could tailor these and maybe even say in some roads that they're sufficiently safe that they could do it. I'm just not sure who, it's a question of who decides, actually. What do you think?
If I understand you correctly, you are kind of wanting me to say whether or not we should have kind of a designated operating area or lanes?
No, not at all. The question is whether whether you feel that we should set out. Do you have a copy of the bill or the CS in front of you, the committee substitute?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I have version G in front of me.
Okay, well, that'll do. If you take a look at the version G, you'll see at the bottom of page 1, line 13, where it talks about the operator of a motor vehicle, of a neighbor electric vehicle, which will, and now be a low-speed vehicle, may not operate the vehicle on a highway that has a maximum speed of more than 35. Whether we should have that written into state law, or whether we should turn the authority to set that particular speed or whatever they wish in the Department of Transportation or at the local, if it's a home rule municipality, whoever it does. But who should decide? Should that be written into state law, or should we delegate the authority to set that?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I believe that the local municipality should have the authority to regulate the use, and that should not be written into state law.
Okay. How about in areas that are not in a municipality? How should we say that? Who normally sets that? Do you know?
Representative Grunberg, no, I do not.
Okay. But I assume then, would you suggest that we have that for the state roads? I'm talking about the Parks Highway or whatever out in an unorganized borough. Should we do that, or should we allow the agency to do that?
I don't know if I follow. What do you mean the agency?
Well, whoever sets it currently. Like on the Parks Highway, who sets that?
Who sets the speed limit?
Yeah.
Representative Grunberg, to the chair, I believe it's the Department of Transportation will set the speed limits.
Okay, then my question to you is whether we as a legislature should set it, or should we say it shall be as designated by the Department of Transportation?
I don't know if I'm beyond my abilities and pay range in offering an opinion
on that. I appreciate that. Thank you. Nothing further.
Lieutenant, I want to get some clarification, because what is being asked here is, do you think that we should allow these vehicles and allow them to be operated on roads within municipal jurisdictions that are above 35 miles an hour? That's the question. If we don't set it in statute, it means that local jurisdictions can either, by not making any designation or making a designation of 55 miles an hour, that they could be operated on any roads within basically the municipality. And I thought your earlier comment was, for safety reasons, they should not be allowed to mix with traffic on roads above 35 miles an hour.
Through the chair, that is correct. I do not believe that these low-speed vehicles should be commingled in any roadway with a speed limit above 35 miles per hour. And further, I feel that we should allow the local or municipalities to set up areas that they deem safe for the operation and commingle of these vehicles.
But the question is, should they be allowed to set a speed limit above 35 miles an hour, or should that be permissive that they could set areas that would be designated and at lower speeds? But, I mean, the question is, should we remove the 35 miles an hour from the statute, which would allow local jurisdictions to set 45 or 50 miles an hour?
Through the chair, no, I believe 35 should stay in.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. That was my question. Representative Gatto.
Yeah, Lieutenant, easy question. You're driving in a 45 zone, and there are some four-wheelers off to the sides doing their usual thing. And you look over, and then you see one of these low-speed vehicles right behind the four-wheelers. Because they're licensed by the state, are they violating the law by being off the pavement?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, no, they would not be violating the law.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for the lieutenant? Or, like I say, we have two other people, Ed Ibbotson and Jack Canelli, that have offered for questions. Does anyone have questions of them?
Yeah, I do.
Which one?
Either one.
Okay. Mr. Canelli?
Yes.
Would you identify yourself for the record, and then I believe Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Jack Canelli. My title is Legal Counsel and Regulatory Specialist for Global Electric Motor Cars. We manufacture electric low-speed vehicles in Fargo, North Dakota.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, Mr. Canelli, you're cutting in and out. I don't know if that's you or what, but it would help if you could maybe...
I'll get off my headset and use the ham.
Yeah, I think that's better. Thank you very much.
Okay, is this better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I gather that you're pretty familiar with how state laws are written on this subject. Okay. And I don't know if you heard my questions about how this law, this bill is drafted vis-a-vis how other states have handled this. Are you, I gather there are like 36 or other states that have such laws, is that right?
Yes, they are. They're about 35, 36.
Are you pretty familiar with those other state laws?
Yes, I am pretty familiar.
Are there anything in any of those state laws that you'd recommend we consider in this bill?
Well, what I would recommend, I think, has already been touched upon as far as adopting the federal standards by reference.
Okay, would you be able to come up and either email or fax to the sponsor suggested language on that?
Certainly.
Okay, good, and I assume you communicate. Any other suggestion you would have, sir?
No, I think for the information of the committee, though, there's a lot of talk about deferring the decision to the local municipalities. And what the vast majority of states have done is that the legislature identifies, defines the cars, and then allows them on streets with speed limits of 35 miles an hour or less. And then the local jurisdiction in some states, have the ability to further restrict them in the interest of public safety if there's a particular stretch of road that could represent a particular hazard. I know the discussion came up in Maine at one time where there was a small community with some heavy logging traffic through their main street, which was a 25 or 35 mile an hour street. I would not recommend allowing the municipalities to go higher than that, to allow them on 45 mile an hour.
Thank you. That's very helpful. The area I was focusing on when I asked the question initially is right here in Juneau, one of the streets connecting an area of Juneau with the rest of Juneau varies. It's actually a two-lane road with a bike path on either side, shoulder kind of thing, and it part of it's 30 miles an hour and part of it gets up to 40. Do you have any thoughts in an area like that?
Well, I think someone mentioned that they are, they would be limited to 35 mile an hour streets by this statute. And I can speak only for our vehicles. We have in our vehicles, we have a label that says that this, this car is restricted to streets with speed limits of 35 miles per hour or less. But there may be, local variations, depending on what state you might be in. So a low-speed vehicle owner would know that if they were on a 40-mile-an-hour street, that they're not operating legally.
I guess they'd just be out of luck. Okay. Well, thank you. If you could get us that language, I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Lynn?
Just a quickie. I assume that if you're on a 35 mile an hour or less street, and you cross a 55 mile an hour street, that's perfectly okay to get to the other side. That would just make common sense.
Yes, and Representative Lynn, that is on page 2, about line 16, where it says that you may cross a highway as long as, let's see, where is it? You may cross the highway.
I see it here. Thank you.
It's a variation of why the chicken crossed the road. Yeah.
It is, yes.
Are there any other questions? Representative Gardner?
Not here.
Thank you. Mr. Cannelli, earlier today, Representative Ramros, who represents an area that's a very cold part of our state, indicated concern about using these vehicles in cold climates and how durable or what kind of special protections they might need. And I'm not sure if he heard you say that they're manufactured in North Dakota. Can you tell us a little bit about how they work in cold temperatures?
Well, although they're manufactured here, North Dakota is not necessarily our biggest market. And it's kind of like, you know, when that discussion was going on, I was thinking in terms of convertibles. You know, it's like the marketplace will kind of, you know, take care of that. I do know that there is a a shopping mall in Bloomington, Minnesota that planned on running these things throughout the year, but then they get to park them indoors at night, and they're on, you know, they're on parking lots that will be, you know, the snow will be cleared off when they're operating on them. They're not, you know, honestly speaking, they're not necessarily a cold weather car. Our standard version doesn't even have doors on it, but although you can buy hard doors, and we do have a defogger, defroster in them. But I think the marketplace would dictate that. But another point, though, is because these are electric cars, they can be operated indoors. So in you know, for larger facilities such as a, you know, a football stadium or something like that, or a large warehouse, you can run them indoors.
Okay, and Representative Gardner, follow up.
I guess my question, what I wanted to know is really a little bit more specific. How well do the batteries hold the charge? I mean, just issues of snow and terrain aside, would they actually function in cold weather?
When you're talking about extreme colds like Fairbanks, I would I can't really answer that one. As far as if you were to just leave it without being plugged into the charger, which I'm assuming, and you have to understand, I'm an attorney English major. I'm not an engineer.
That's fine. Then we won't make you answer that. I think we all know what cold does to batteries here.
Right, I'm sure you do.
Thank you.
So appreciate that. Is there any further questions for anybody? Okay. I think we have a couple of conceptual amendments here. Yes, Representative Groomer.
And I know that Representative Thomas has been in and out, but his constituent was the person that has been waiting on the line. I don't know if he'd like to say a few words. He's the driving force behind the bill, and maybe he'd like to say the fellow from Skagway.
Well, he didn't sign up to testify. Mr. Ibbotson, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yeah, you've heard our discussion. Is there anything you wish to add?
Well, some of the things that's been mentioned, like the other gentleman said, the marketplace is going to kind of dictate. These vehicles aren't made for every application and every use. They're made for the person who two times a week needs to run down to the grocery store or, you know, to the post office, but doesn't want the expense of maintaining year-round a gasoline-powered vehicle with all the inherent stuff that goes with them. I think you all know that, you know, very short runs and low usage is very hard on a gas vehicle. And the other thing, the commingling of vehicles, you know, I've heard some of the testimony, well, we, you know, we're going to have these things mixed in with large cars and trucks. And on that line, we don't have any problem licensing scooters and little things like little Honda Civics.
Thank you, Mr. Ibbotson. Would you identify yourself and any affiliation for the record here?
Okay, I'm sorry. My name is Ed Ibbotson. How this all got started is I wanted to do a car rental business for tourists here and then found out that these vehicles weren't legal. And in talking with some of the local people, I found out there was interest from people who thought these things would be ideal for, you know, like Skagway, where the town is small and, you know, just be ideal for basically some of the older people who don't want to mess around with a car.
And Mr. Ibbotson, I think we all agree with you, and we appreciate you forwarding this idea. I don't mean to cut you off, but we've got a lot of bills to take care of, and I think we want to see, since this is going to now have two other committees or referral, I think we would like to make a couple of conceptual amendments and move this out. And unless there's something else you need to add, I'd like to thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome, and I thank you people for your time on this.
Great. Thanks. So I think with our discussions with DMV, we've had two conceptual amendments. First conceptual amendment would be to page 2, line 20, change low-speed vehicle, a definition to conceptually, a low-speed vehicle has the meaning as identified in federal law, and that's conceptual, so the right statutes and everything will be brought forward. Is there any objection to that amendment that I'm offering?
I'll object just for the purpose of a question.
Representative Rammers.
The federal definition, does that include a gas vehicle, or does that only include electric vehicles?
Let's ask the sponsor.
I can answer that. Representative Rammers, in the federal regs, it does not specify that it is an electrical vehicle.
All right. And just a clarification, Mr. Chairman, I'm not an idiot, and I'm not suggesting that people are going to drive these vehicles from October until the springtime, but we do have the requirement of storing a vehicle in a warm weather spot, which requires a housed, heated structure in Arctic conditions. So I just want to clarify, nobody's suggesting that I'm going to ride around in December when it's 30 below in a golf cart. So we're on the record here that we may be cold in Fairbanks, but we are bright.
Thank you for that, Representative Rammer.
Sure.
So are you going to remove your objection?
Yes, I will remove it.
Okay, so Representative Gardner, objection for discussion?
Yes, for discussion, and I think the distinction between electric vehicles and the gas vehicles is partly one of noise. So I'm a little bit concerned about that, because if the electric vehicles are quiet, that's great, but I don't know that we want to necessarily allow something that may be very, very different in volume. The Lawnmower Act.
Representative Gatto.
Just in response, I mean, non-electric vehicles include propane, which are used in warehouses all the time, which are as quiet. Uh-huh. So
are pretty quiet.
It's inclusive. And you're right, a two-cycle go-kart with no muffler is pretty potent.
Yeah. Do we want to approve those for our highway, our neighborhoods?
That was Representative Gardner responding to Representative Gatto. Representative Gruenberg has a question for Mr. Cannelli. Yeah. Are you still online?
Mr. Cannelli, are you still there?
I am still online.
Just one question. I don't know if you heard Representative Gardner, but you're pretty familiar, I assume, with the whole industry. Is that correct?
I'm not really that familiar with what competitors we have. There are some, but I'm not very. I really can't speak about them very.
He's their legal counsel, not the engineer. So,
yeah.
Thank you for coming back. So we have a conceptual amendment. Do you want to maintain your objection, Representative Gardner?
I wish there were somebody here who could answer the question.
I was going to ask Mr. Cannelli, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
The question is, you're familiar with the federal definition, and the question is, are vehicles under that federal definition quiet, or are they real loud putt-putts?
The federal definition specifically allows both gas and electric. That was part of the discussion in the comments, I think. But I'm not aware of who the low-speed vehicle manufacturers are that have gas ones, other than maybe a John Deere Gator, but that's not even an on-road vehicle, so I'm not even aware of any right now.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Cannelli. We don't have anybody that can answer that question, so I'm not going to ask people to go beyond their areas of expertise. Okay.
I'll remove my objection.
Okay, so we have, are there any further objections to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. We have another conceptual amendment, and that would be to be page 2, following line 18, and that would be to allow local jurisdictions to further regulate for safety concerns.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Representative Gruber.
Just an objection of a question, I'm going to remove my objection, but it's really a question. I think that I'm not sure, and we can ask bill sponsor and Mr. Luckup. I'm not sure that that's totally going to be necessary, because that may be assumed under existing state law anyway. So I would ask that you, in your conceptual amendment, we make it clear that we would like this amendment, but if it's not necessary, they don't have to put it in. Is that okay?
We've got transportation co-chairs here. They can remove it at the next one if it's not.
That's fine. Either way.
Conceptual amendment two, did you want to remove your objection?
I do.
Okay. Is there any further objection to conceptual amendment number two? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number two is adopted. Are there any further amendments to be offered? Is there anyone else in the online to testify on this bill? Is there anyone else in the audience to testify on the bill? Public hearing was closed a little while ago. Sorry, amending the bill.
Just one question.
Yes, Representative Gruber.
I assume that with amendment number one, we don't have to worry about the word electric. That'll go out anyway. But thanks. Sure. I move my objection.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll move CS for House Bill 403, version F, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes as amended.
Is there any objection to moving House Bill 403 with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations? Seeing none, the bill moves from the committee. Next, we have...
If slowly.
Yeah. It's a slow-speed vehicle. Next, we have HCR 27. Davis. Divest investments from Iran and North Korea. And we have the bill sponsor here, Representative Ramis.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Emily Stancliffe and Jane Pearson are going to present on this. And then I will take my drubbing from the Permanent Fund Corporation. It's been the seventh grade since I had a sound whooping, and I intend to get one this afternoon, or this morning.
Hmm. So, Representative Ramrus, did you want to introduce your staff members, or did you?
I did. Ms. Emily Stancliffe and Jane Pearson from our office.
Okay, thank you. And would you go ahead and individually not only identify yourself, but if you switch back and forth, would you identify yourself each time? Thanks.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Once again, my name is Emily Stancliffe, staff to Representative Ramrus. And before you in your packet, you have HCR 27. Included in the packet is also a report entitled The Terrorism Investments of the 50 States, published by the Center for Security Policy, www.divestterror.org. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to look over that, but I wanted to bring some notice to some of the percentages and numbers that they've raised in that while we speak for Resolution 27. The U.S. Department of State, as well as the Office of Foreign Assets Control from the United States Treasury, have identified that Iran and North Korea are state sponsors of terrorism. This nation's largest and most prominent public pension systems tend to be heavily invested in globally publicly traded companies that have business activities in terrorist-sponsoring states, which includes Iran and North Korea. On average, America's top 100 pension systems invest anywhere between 15 and 23% of their portfolios in companies that do business in terrorist-sponsoring states. The total estimated value of stock of some 400 companies doing business in terrorist-sponsoring states, including Iran and North Korea, is over $188 billion. According to the Center for Security Policy, who did the report, the Alaska Retirement Management Board invests 24% of its total equity holdings in companies with ties to terrorist sponsoring nations. The Alaska Retirement Management Board holdings are linked to 98 companies that are involved in terrorist sponsoring states. Of those 98 companies, 68 have dealings in Iran and 8 have dealings in North Korea. In total, the 98 companies have invested in terrorist-sponsoring states a total of $27 billion, and that's actually a minimum of $27 billion. In the report, the Conflict Securities Advisory Group, who did the analysis of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, identified a few stocks that are on their Dirty Dozen list, and of those, we found that the Permanent Fund Corporation also has holdings with those stocks, and we've estimated a total value of $76 million in those five stocks that the Permanent Fund has holdings in. The dealings of each company are varied. There's an example of what the Conflict Securities Group has listed as reasons why they're on their Dirty Dozen list. That's included in your packet as well if you wanted to know what their reasoning was. But we have identified that the Permanent Fund Corporation does have holdings in those stocks and many numerous others that we're not aware of, because once again, this report only focused on the Alaskan Retirement Management Board, not actually the Permanent Fund. But we did find that we needed to address the Permanent Fund as well when we drafted this legislation. Other states across the country have drafted similar legislation. Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Arizona. Retirement boards of the state of Missouri, the state of California, and the New York City Fire Department have hired companies to investigate where their pension funds are being invested, and have tried to lead the way in drafting legislation that prevents retirement boards from investing in countries that sponsor terrorism. Peter Tarnoff, who was, I believe, the Secretary of Defense, let me see. He was former Clinton Secretary of State. He said, and I quote, "A straight line links Iran's oil income and its ability to sponsor terrorism, build weapons of mass destruction, and acquire sophisticated armaments. Any government or private company that helps Iran to expand its oil must accept that it is contributing to this menace." And I believe that we share that view, and that is one of the reasons why we felt this legislation was necessary, to send a clear statement that Alaska is not willing to financially support those countries who seek to cause harm to this country and this state. And so we ask that you consider this legislation and pass it out of the committee.
Can you explain for me just a little bit? There's four-star companies here with the permanent fund: France, Italy, Norway, and Switzerland.
Correct.
And then those are broken out where the permanent fund has 65 investments for France.
Right.
And would you run through, I'm not asking you to run through all of these.
Sure.
But I'm just, why are those four countries picked out, and what are these trying to tell us?
Okay. If you'll, there's a page from part of the report that actually was the analysis by the Conflict Securities Group of the, at the time, the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. At the bottom of that sheet, they listed five different companies with the sample of holdings in those companies. We took those names and we went to the Permanent Fund Holdings page and printed off those countries that these specific companies were in, and then that's why they're starred, because they were the ones that were notated on this report from the Conflict Securities Group. So in seeing that the Conflict Securities Group had chosen them as companies of note, I went to the PFD holdings and tried to verify that we also were holding them with a PFD, not just the Alaska Retirement Management Board.
Okay, so these countries are identified then because they are...
They're where those companies are based out of.
That is where the companies are based out of.
Right.
That have...
Right, for example, Alcatel S.A. Is headquartered in France, and it's one of the ones that was starred on the list of the PFD holdings. And as an example, you know, they list it on the Dirty Dozen because of its relevance to its activities in Iran. And world leader in the telecommunications sector, Alcatel is undertaking technology advanced projects in three terrorist sponsoring states, and has projects totaling over $300 million in terrorist sponsoring states. So once we realized that that was something that the Retirement Management Board held, we tried to go over to the Permanent Fund and find out if it was also held by the PFD. And that's why you'll see it starred on that list, that it's held in both of the Management Board, Permanent Fund Corporation, and the Retirement Management Board.
Okay, so this is dissimilar from the legislation, the other legislation that we have, in that this is not dealing with, not having dealings with the countries that are the headquarters for companies that deal with those, with other countries that we don't, that we're disagreeing with in this bill. This is only going to talk about disagreeing with the, or not investing in the companies, but not in the countries themselves.
Correct, Mr. Chair. And I, are you referring to Senate Bill 12,
yes,
the trafficking bill that we've heard? Yes, that's correct. We're not taking issue with the countries themselves that these companies are based out of. We're simply asking for the holdings to be divested from the companies, these publicly held companies, and not actually the country that these companies are housed in.
Are there further questions for the sponsor?
Yeah,
Representative Grunberg.
I appreciate the chair's questions, and I'm slightly confused because, like you've said here, Ms. Stancliffe, by the way, I appreciate the excellence of your testimony.
Thank you.
Did a good job. We invest in companies. We don't invest in countries. And so I'm slightly still confused by that concept in the other bill. And this is just a resolution. It doesn't direct. It simply urges. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. It is just a resolution. Excuse me, through the chair, Ms. Representative Grunberg. We believe it brings attention to the need for Alaska to set an example of refusing to invest in companies that directly threaten our security as a nation, as a state. You know, North Korea is the first in line when North Korea when decides to turn missiles on the United States of America. We're the closest state to them, and we feel that it's necessary to set a precedent and to be an example that we're no longer willing to sponsor these companies in these countries.
I understand. Now, you've referenced here on page 2, lines 8, something that I'm not familiar with. It's the Office of Foreign Assets Control in the Department of the Treasury. What is the Office of Foreign Assets Control?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it was through researching these articles that the Office of Foreign Assets Control was quoted in other legislation that we were researching where that was referenced as being identified.
You know anything about that agency?
I'm not personally familiar with the goings on of that agency. I can find out for you and provide that information as to what their main purposes are.
The reason I'm asked, Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg,
is because if there's some agency in the foreign government, I mean in the federal government, not foreign government, my goodness, the federal government that looks to these countries, which some of them go in and out of terrorist activities as kind of a boutique industry, I guess, I don't know. But why are we limiting it to these countries, because tomorrow they could change regimes and change and become allies of the United States, and then we have another country that becomes the haven for the terrorists. Do we know that these are the only two countries? And, you know, you see what I'm getting at here.
Correct. The Department of State has listed multiple countries, including, you know, Sudan and other countries that we specifically didn't choose to list in this resolution. It was Iran and North Korea that we were being specific to. And so you're correct in saying that there are other countries that have been identified, but this resolution speaks only to Iran and North Korea. I'm sure we could factor in other countries if they were concerns of the committee.
I'm just wondering through the chair why you chose only two.
Top bananas.
Actually, I believe Representative Rammers could maybe speak better to that than I could, so I defer to him.
Sure. Representative Rammers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Emily doing a great job in presenting this. Representative Grunberg, we think that North Korea and Iran represent two of the gravest threats, and Presently, North Korea could blow up our country. We draw a pretty bright line between companies that make trans fatty food, sell tobacco, or invest in casinos, and those that want to blow up the Western Hemisphere and end our life as we know it. And we selected Iran because we have about 4,000 of our troops here in the state of Alaska that are over in Iraq right now with the country of Iran agitating to undermine the safety and security of our young men and women who are in harm's way right now. And we were concerned about spreading this out to all terrorist-sponsoring states as perhaps a too great of an undertaking, as we will hear when the Permanent Fund tries to refute our intention of cleaning and sanitizing a little bit our investment strategy, because it appears that while young Alaskans are over protecting our way of life, that the Retirement Board and the Permanent Fund are busy trying to empower terrorist-sponsoring states to bring capital into their countries so that they can export terrorism and undermine our safety and security. And that is the issue that we wish to highlight today. And we think that we can do that in a satisfactory manner with these two countries and in dialogue with the bill sponsor, Senate Bill 12. We have included those as a Tier 3 country at that sponsor's request.
I guess I had a question. In the resolution, we're talking about on line 10, the Center for Security Policy, and I don't find in any of the literature who they are other than a private, I guess it's a private organization, is that correct?
Right, it is, and it's actually the, they provided the report that we used quite heavily to base this resolution off of. So that's the report that's in front of you entitled The Terrorism Investments of the 50 States.
But I guess what I'm trying to find out is that we don't have any reference here in the executive summary or the footnotes or anything else of who that private organization is that we're relying on to set state policy. I mean, it's not a governmental organization, as
right.
I understand it, and I don't see any listing of their members or who they are or what their doesn't set out their purpose. It just sets out their study, and then we're setting state policy based on that organization. I'm just wondering who they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can provide that for you. I failed to do that, and I guess in just providing the report, wanted to at least show what they had found, but I can get more information for you as to the members that you'd like.
So. I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Representative Gatto?
In line with some of these other requests, I notice on the second page, right under the sponsor statement, it's titled Spotting Links to Terrorism. And you go down to the middle somewhere, and it says, earlier this month, a socially responsible investors group announced it had compiled a list. And this group, the Investor Responsibility Research Center, along with the Conflict Securities Advisory Group. We get so many names, you wonder if they're terrorist groups that are just putting information out. And so I would ask, if you could, to at least get a piece of information on where the groups are headquartered is
okay.
Usually helpful, maybe if, you know, California or where, and typically something about their history. Are they really people that are more interested in preventing whales from being taken or cutting redwoods and also happen to be involved in everything and anything? I would like to know that without having to look it up myself.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gatto, through the chair. On page 8 of that report, it actually talks to the Conflict Securities Advisory Group as being an independent and impartial Washington-based risk assessment firm. I believe, actually, there is a gentleman online who might be willing to answer any questions that you have about that group, in particular, Adam Penner. He can give you more information just about the dealings of that group, but they are a group that did the assessment of the retirement boards and ran the portfolios and who offer their services to retirement boards and across the nation and have been assisting many states in identifying similar issues that we're raising today, companies that are invested in countries that are sponsoring terrorism. So if you had any particular questions for him, I believe he probably would answer those for you, or he would, I'm sure.
I guess just on the first page of that, spotting links to terrorism one is interesting on about the fifth paragraph down. But of the 30 or so other companies linked to proliferation issues, some two-thirds hail from the United States. And, you know, at some point in time, we have to figure out if we've got two-thirds of the countries that are linked with proliferation of weapons of mass destruction coming from the United States, that we also might have some, you know, consistency problems with where we're going. But Representative Gardner, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. But on that point, I think that the next sentence there is relevant, that it may be that we just do a better job of identifying them because we're looking for it. So it may be that other countries might find the same sort of results if they were looking as we are. I would just like to say to the sponsor, I think this is very interesting, and it opens a whole kind of trapdoor we fall into. How do you do the right thing
yes.
when there's so much we don't know? And I'm interested in hearing this.
Sure, and we'll hear some testimony here in a minute, I'm sure, from others. So. Does anyone else have any questions? Representative Ramos, did you have a question for your staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was waving at my chief of staff.
Oh. Very good job of presenting the issue for us. And,
you,
and if you'll be around, we'll take some testimony and then we'll talk to you some more. Thanks. If we have some more questions. Let's see. We have online, I believe, Christopher Holton.
Yes, sir. That's me.
Yes. Would you identify yourself, who you're affiliated with, and go ahead with your testimony? And we're going to run out of time, so if you could keep it fairly short, we'd appreciate it.
I'll do my best, sir. My name is Christopher Holton. I am a vice president with the Center for Security Policy. In fact, I head up the center's Divest Terror Initiative. The Center for Security Policy is a national security think tank founded in 1988 by Frank Gaffney, the president of the Center for Security Policy. He is a former official of the Reagan administration Pentagon. Our mission is to promote peace through strength. We're nonpartisan, and we were involved, for instance, in national missile defense and in the formation of the Rumsfeld Commission through the Institute of the North a few years ago. Some people up in Alaska may be familiar with this due to that. My primary duty with the Center for Security Policy is divest terror. And we've had action in several states, in Arizona, in Illinois, in Louisiana, and in Missouri. In getting this type of legislation going. Basically what we do is the State Department has identified official state sponsors of terrorism in their annual report, Patterns of Global Terrorism. And those countries are Iran, Syria, Libya, North Korea, and Sudan. And while U.S. companies are forbidden from doing business in those countries, by virtue of sanctions, for the most part, foreign companies have stepped in and done a tremendous amount of business with those countries, particularly Iran, for instance. Now, what we think, this is a moral hazard. We think this is a moral issue that state pension system holders around the country need to be informed that their investment dollars are going to companies that are doing business with those that are killing us, that are literally killing us. In the case of Iran and Syria, both of those countries are heavily involved in the insurgency in Iraq. And that's not the Center for Security Policy saying that. That is well accepted. In fact, Iran basically tacitly admits that they are involved in the insurgency in Iraq. So right now you have members of the Alaskan National Guard, of the 297th Infantry Brigade and the 207th Aviation Battalion fighting in Iran, in Iraq, against jihadist insurgents who are armed, trained, equipped, and supported by Iran and Syria. At the same time that this is going on, the Alaska State Pension Investment Board has investments in 68 companies with ties to Iran and 34 companies with ties to Syria. We think that this is information that needs to get out there, and we think that this is something that needs to stop. We've been successful in other states in this initiative going forward and stopping these this practice. And at this point, I'll be happy to take any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bolton. And just a quick answer on this. Have you you have initiatives in other states. Have any of those other states passed similar legislation yet?
Yes. We have had legislation pass in Missouri, Illinois, and Louisiana, and Arizona.
Thank you. And let's see. I guess... does anyone else have any other questions?
Well, I
guess I just have one question. If a company such as BP or Exxon or ConocoPhillips were was buying oil from Iran, would that be a country that was doing business with Iran?
Well, I can't accept the premise of your question, sir, because those companies cannot do directly business with Iran. Someone mentioned the Office of Foreign Assets Control earlier. That is the arm of the Treasury Department that monitors U.S. sanctions policy. And ExxonMobil cannot go into Iran and help them with their oil program. However, foreign companies like Total SA from France have come in and do billions of dollars worth of business in Iran. Theoretically, if one of those companies was doing business directly with Iran, that would be a problem. But the fact is that is not going on, and that is currently against U.S. law.
Investment in those countries or purchasing oil from those countries?
They can't do business with those countries.
Okay, but can they do business with companies that are located that have business in those countries?
Well, I would imagine that Exxon could theoretically do business with Total. Now, in terms of buying oil directly from Iran, they cannot do that.
Okay, but they could buy it from somebody else who's buying it from there.
I don't know that for a fact.
Okay, Representative Rammers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, sir. I appreciate you calling in to testify on this important issue today. My question for you is the pension boards for these other states, for Arizona, Louisiana, Illinois, how did they refute the prudent investor rule in those states? Because that's going to be the objection that we have from the ARM board and the permanent fund board here today.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. Always the response from the investment community is this is either going to be too costly, or it's going to cause portfolio performance to suffer, or it's just too difficult to do, it can't be done. The short answer to all those objections is that's just not true. For instance, the Louisiana Sheriff's pension system in Louisiana has divested from this group of this category. And other in Missouri, there is a terrorist-free pension system. They have managed to do this despite the fact that they were told that it was going to be costly. In fact, the actuarial analysis from the Louisiana State House Representatives Retirement Committee found that this was a revenue-neutral initiative. In other words, it did not cost the system a thing. There is no reason why this has to negatively impact portfolio performance. There are ways of divestment that can mitigate that impact. Divestment can occur in staged amounts over a period of time. Nobody is suggesting that these stocks should be dumped en masse immediately, the way that it has been done in the past, for instance, with South Africa divestment, is that perhaps over a period of 3 years, portions of the portfolio might be divested. It might not be the easiest thing that money managers have to do, but I would suggest to you that the young men and women of the U.S. military who are fighting in Iraq today and in Afghanistan today are not doing something that's really easy either. And what we're not doing is supporting them. This is something that is a moral issue that needs to be addressed across the country.
Thank you, Mr. Holton. And where are you calling from?
I am currently in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thank you. Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Gatto.
Yeah, thanks very much. I think it's clear to everybody here, and probably you too, that simply buying Iranian or oil is a big deal that helps them enormously. And yet this state, in trying to develop its resources on the coastal plain, meet resistance. I'm not sure where Louisiana stands, but wouldn't it be pretty darn patriotic for a lot of countries who are interested in this sort of thing to say, we certainly want to quit buying Middle East oil from these terrorists, and rather, why don't we just develop our own? I think that's a message that we've been trying to get out for some time, and I've got to hand it to Representative Ramos for at least saying, you know, we've got to do something, but and the something he's doing, I think, is pretty darn important, but so is the idea of saying we've got to do what we can to avoid all these purchases from the Middle East countries. And we have an opportunity right here to take care of that problem. Is that kind of a message ever leak out into some of these communities that you're familiar with?
Well, I'll tell you this. Middle East Newsline is a news service that covers the Middle East extensively out of Canada. And they reported not long ago that Iran makes $35 billion a year approximately off of their oil and gas exports. Now, I don't know what price of oil that was based off of. We know that the price of oil has obviously gone up significantly. And the lady who testified earlier mentioned the former Clinton administration undersecretary of state who drew a direct line between doing business with Iran's oil industry and helping their terrorist activities. So there is definitely a sense that dependence on Middle East oil is not a good thing at all. And Iran is one of the major OPEC players, they help set OPEC policy.
Mr. Holton, we've got to go on, and we're not going to get through here today. But I do appreciate your answers. Does anyone else have any other questions? Representative Lynn.
Well, he may not be the one to answer it. I was going to ask Representative Ramos, but we mentioned Syria. Why not include Syria in this mix?
Well, we'll get back to when Representative Ramos returns to ask that question. Let's see. We have Mead Treadwell.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Mr. Chairman, I'm Mead Treadwell. I reside at 528 N Street in Anchorage, and I'm a senior fellow at the Institute of the North and direct the Institute's Defense and Security Program. The Institute, as many of you know, was founded by former Alaska Governor Wally Hickel to help develop policy on issues strategic to Alaska and its future. And for close to 10 years, Mr. Chairman, the Institute has worked with other national, international, and state-based think tanks on the proposition that action at the state level can help improve the security of the United States. Should state governments be concerned about national security? Absolutely. In Alaska, we understand our geographic position. We understand our role in hosting the military and sending our sons and daughters abroad. We understand we're close to North Korea. We understand the pipeline is a terrorist target. We understand our energy helps America diversify its supply. But we also need to understand our role as an investor in providing funds to parts of the world that could or would do harm to us. With the Center for Security Policy in Washington, the Claremont Institute in California, the Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis at Tufts, our program has helped the nation understand Alaska's vital role in U.S. security over the last 10 years, and we've helped Alaskans play a more effective role ourselves. I should also say that this Divest Terror campaign is a very interesting coalition of people coming from the left and the right, people coming from business and labor, people concerned about slavery in Sudan and nuclear proliferation, and you're working with very, very fine people here in the names of the people the institutions that were brought up in this hearing. As far back as 1996, the Institute began looking at missile threats to Alaska and the position of the U.S. government then, which was not to include Alaska under the umbrella of a proposed ballistic missile defense system. It was a resolution of the Alaska legislature in 1997 which called for a new intelligence estimate on missile threats to Alaska, and Senator Stevens told us resulted in the Rumsfeld Commission. Over several years, we helped shift U.S. policy to build a system in Alaska, not for our economy, but for our protection. We've hosted a continuing series of follow-up conferences on these issues involving many of your present and former colleagues. Mr. Chairman, there's one conclusion we've found in every meeting we've had assessing the threats to the United States. Terrorism and nuclear threats run on money. Terrorism finds refuge in states with regimes that support terrorists, and money, usually outside money brought in from the world market economy, either as investment or trade, is the mother's milk of terrorism. Alaska's major funds, the permanent fund and our pension funds, could find themselves unwitting players in this process. This resolution calls for a stop to that by a simple, inexpensive process that several other states and leading pension funds have taken on to review their portfolios. I was able to see a copy of the document circulated by the Permanent Fund Corporation at the last meeting of this committee. Mr. Chairman, what I saw there is a kind of a scare tactic, a huge price tag meant to dissuade you and this committee from passing a resolution that would free Alaskans from the concerns that their permanent fund might be supporting terrorism. Between the last meeting and this, we were in contact with the Conflict Securities Advisory Group, one of several firms states and pension funds have hired to review their portfolios against concerns they unwittingly invest in terrorism or nuclear threats to the United States. The firm has told me that they'd be able to offer the state of Alaska a full screening service for its permanent fund and the state pension fund for a discounted rate of $5,000. And, Mr. Chairman, before this legislature concludes its business this spring, I believe you could be aware of how many stocks and of what value Alaska's portfolio is exposed through investments in terrorism. The term exposure is not one I use lightly. While some investment funds have cautioned that divestment of stocks investing in terrorist states could lose them money, I believe this process reduces risk that the stocks would take a sharp fall. Several firms, such as General Electric and ConocoPhillips, have, because of concerns raised like those in this resolution, have themselves divested activities in Iran, for example, to make sure they are not exposed. Shouldn't we be doing the same thing?
Thank you, Mr. Treadwell. Appreciate your testimony. We're going to run out of time here. So.
All right. Well, just to conclude, Mr. Chairman, this is a resolution, not a law. And it commits us to a process of monitoring our investments in national security and gives the Permanent Fund Board the flexibility to take this on. We're the owners of the Permanent Fund, and Governor Hickel likes to remind us we're an owner state, and I think as owners we deserve to give our asset managers a little advice now and then. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Treadwell, I've been very impressed with your testimony, and I wonder if you have a written copy you could provide to us.
I do, and I will. Through Ms. Stancliffe, I'll send it down this morning.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's see. That was listen only. Do we have the Permanent Fund Board here? Good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your comments on the
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Ashe. I'm the Director of Communications for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I apologize that I am the only one here this morning representing the Permanent Fund. At this moment, our full board, our executive director, are all upstairs making a presentation to the Joint House and Senate Finance Committees, and this was something that was scheduled before session started. So they were not able to be here. Before I go into the testimony that Mr. Burns had prepared, I'm pleased to hear that CSAG, the Council for Security Advisory Groups, has given a quote of $5,000, because when I spoke to Adam Penner last week, he actually told me it'd be $15,000 per each of our 40 managers to buy their Divest Terror product. So it sounds like they've changed their mind and are going to offer us a significant discount. I would like to point out that for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation itself to purchase the list does us not as much good. It helps us evaluate what's in our current portfolios, but we don't make any of our purchase or divestment transactions in-house. So every one of our managers would also have to purchase this list. You've got the copies of our cost analysis in front of you, and so if they were willing to offer it to be $5,000 per manager as opposed to the $15,000 we were quoted, you could make that change in the spreadsheets that we provided you. One other quick thing before I go into the written testimony, I would like to make it clear that it's never the Permanent Fund Corporation's intent to ever provide a drubbing to anyone in the committee. We're here today so that the committee can have the full range of facts in front of them as they choose their deliberations on this resolution. The Permanent Fund Board is required to act as fiduciaries, and unfortunately that means that they have to approach every decision from a financial perspective. And so with that, I would like to read the testimony that Mr. Burns had prepared. We appreciate the reasons that the sponsor would have for bringing this resolution forward. No United States citizen wants to support countries that seek to harm the U.S. either directly or through the actions of our state and local government. However, I am here today to represent the Permanent Fund's Board of Trustees and their role as fiduciaries of the fund. The common law duty that has been termed the most fundamental duty owed by a fiduciary is to administer a fund solely for the financial good of its beneficiaries. Therefore, any social investment restriction will raise concerns for the trustees. These concerns of the board and the APFC staff can be summarized in 3 points. First, the Board of Trustees does not believe that any social investment restrictions are compatible with their charge by state statute and the prudent investment rule to act as fiduciaries of the Permanent Fund. Second, the APFC believes that the restrictions suggested by this resolution will have a significant increase in management fees, divestiture costs, and potential loss revenues in the future. And finally, while we can appreciate the desire to bring about change through investment guidelines, we believe that the efficacy of these measures has not been proved and is not guaranteed to produce the desired result. The statutes are very clear. The fund must be invested under the guidelines of the prudent investor rule. Statutes also direct that the fund should provide a means of conserving a portion of the state's revenue from mineral resources to benefit all generations of Alaskans, maintain safety of principal while maximizing total return, and be used as a savings device managed to allow the maximum use of disposable income from the fund for purposes designated by law. Any directive to invest in or divest of any asset for any reason other than for the financial benefit of the fund's beneficiaries would run counter to all of the directives and statute. On December 15th of last year, the board's corporate governance committee met and approved by motion a statement on behalf of the Board of Trustees. The statement reads, "The corporate governance committee reaffirms the position that social investment policies do not serve the fund's statutory mission of investing for maximum return while protecting principal." I believe the trustees' position on this issue has been made clear. However, if the trustees were to divest the fund of companies with ties to Iran and North Korea, it would raise two questions. First, how do we know which companies to divest from and avoid purchasing in the future? And what will be the cost of the fund, both in manager fees and lost returns? First, how to determine which companies are the companies in question? The federal government, via the Securities and Exchange Commission, would be a good source of information. However, they have declined to produce a list of companies that invest in terror-sponsoring states. So we turn to private sector offerers. There are only two firms that could provide the Permanent Fund with this information. Institutional Shareholder Services is a widely recognized firm that primarily offers research for proxy voting issues. They also provide lists on companies that invest in Sudan and more recently in terror-sponsoring states. However, ISS has publicly warned that their list should be used for informational purposes and is not intended as a divestment list. Conflict Securities Advisory Group, from whom we've heard today, also offers a list of companies invested in terror-sponsoring states. CSAG clearly states on their website that they do not separate companies that are in terror-sponsoring states for humanitarian reasons versus those with purely economic motivations or even the scale of economic involvement. And I would like to point out also that Adam Penner has publicly also said that their divestment list should actually not be used as a divestment list, but only for informational purposes. So that essentially leaves us with two public providers that say we can give you a list, but we don't recommend you use it as a divestment list. The New York State Comptroller's Office wrote to several companies on CSAG's list last fall to inquire of their specific activities. And this would go back to your questions about purchasing oil. Perhaps it could be related. In one case, the company paid half of a local consultant's salary for information on what was occurring in the ground on Sudan, on the ground in Sudan. Siemens, another company on CSAG's list, has stated that while they do have a joint venture in Iran, they are in full compliance with existing international embargoes and sanctions. The APFC has questions regarding the reliability of the information on these lists based on the statements of the firms themselves and the subsequent investigation of the companies named. If the Board of Trustees were to move forward despite the concerns over the information contained in these lists for purchases, the APFC would next have to address cost. One cost would be the cost of the divestment lists. The APFC does not make any internal equities trades and uses four external fixed income managers in addition to our internal fixed income department. Thus, the fund's external managers would all have to purchase one of the lists available in order to properly screen the fund's current portfolio and any future purchases. We expect that the managers would pass this cost back to the fund, in part based on information gleaned in our conversations with ISS and CSAG regarding their current clients. Including our internal fixed income department, we have 39 managers, each paying an annual fee. We estimate the annual cost of the permanent fund would range from $207,000 to $585,000. And as I mentioned, that was before we got a new price quote of $5,000. This could be affected by the manager's decision to charge the APFC. The next step in the cost analysis would be the cost of divesting the permanent fund's portfolios of the companies on the list. One specific portfolio that I would like to mention is our Cap Guardian Emerging Markets portfolio. Currently, our portfolio is commingled with funds from several other large institutional investors, which provides a significant cost savings. In order to comply with this specific divestment directive, we would have to pull out of that common fund to create a custom portfolio, incurring both divestment costs and increased annual fees. The specific details of the divestment costs for our portfolios are broken down for you in the handout we provided. In summary, we estimate the range of divestment costs to be from $19 million to $37 million. These estimated costs don't include the cost of searching for new managers if our existing managers choose to terminate our relationship because of the difficulties associated with these new restrictions. And there will be annual costs to comply with the new restrictions. We estimate our manager fees for the equity portfolio will increase by about $16 million per year, in addition to the annual cost of procuring the divestment list. For comparison, the permanent fund has a budget of $47 million for manager fees for FY06. We also believe that while small compared to the other costs, there will be increased costs and necessary staff time to monitor managers' compliance with these restrictions, additional due diligence, and additional consultants' fees. Also, we must consider the potential loss of revenue to the fund. While it is difficult to predict what this might be, we've put together some rough estimates of various scenarios and have included the details in the information provided to you. Our rough estimate shows losses of as much as $52 million per year.
Laura, yes, do you have more?
I just have a little bit more. Okay. So now that I've outlined the specific issues of how this resolution could affect the fund, I'd like to take a few minutes to address the topic of social investment policies in general. One question is whether divesting of the companies would have any effect at all on discouraging them from investing in terror-sponsoring states. While the permanent fund seems large from the Alaskan point of view, we are very small from the point of view of the companies we invest in. Generally, the fund owns less than 1% of any company, and if we were to sell our shares, other buyers from around the world would be there to take our place. But if our divestiture were to have the desired effect of encouraging companies to pull out of the countries in question, would it produce the desired result? While aggression against the United States and aggression against a country's own citizens do create slightly different circumstances, there are enough similarities in purpose behind the suggested divestiture from terror-sponsoring states and the move to divest from South Africa in the 1980s to draw a comparison on the efficacy of these measures. Conventional wisdom over the years has held that boycotting South Africa was very effective and brought the country to its knees. This conclusion does not hold up against the facts. In 1999, a group of economic researchers from several organizations collaborated on what is considered to be the definitive review of the South African boycott. Their findings were published in the Journal of Business, and the group concluded that despite the prominence and publicity of the boycott and the multitude of divesting companies, the financial markets valuation of targeted companies, or even the South African financial markets themselves, were not easily visibly affected. The conclusion we can draw from this is that even if the companies that the fund is invested in withdrew from terror sponsoring states, it's not guaranteed to have the desired effect of bringing about change in those countries. I'm not here to recommend the committee vote for or against this resolution. Board of Trustees respects the legislature's authority to provide direction in how the permanent fund is invested. However, I do urge the committee to carefully consider the definite and potential financial consequences of supporting any social investment restriction on the fund, as well as the probability the restriction has of producing the intended benefit. Thank you for your opportunity to testify on this resolution.
Chairman. Okay, thank you. And we have several questions here. And first of all, I have one, and that is on your breakdown of initial costs. You have the S&P 500 and S&P 400. Are those index funds, passive index funds, does that mean the divestiture would be required of those?
Yes.
S&P 400 and 500, okay, thank you. And we have Representative Ramirez, and we're going to have to, we're going to have to end soon. So yes. Representative Ramirez and then Representative Lynn.
Big picture question, Laura.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you think that we would have saved money with the bus system if Rosa Parks would have just got on the back of the bus instead of the front of the bus?
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, the Board of Trustees of the Permanent Fund is not in a position to debate the relative moral implications of any social investment restriction. Their job is to act as fiduciaries of the fund.
Okay, Representative Lynn.
Mine might be along similar lines. I understand prudent investment rules, but and you said you should evaluate investments only from a financial perspective. In other words, how much money you can make from an investment. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Yeah, well, then, if I may, so that would include drug cartels and the mafia? You have a lot of money there.
And through the chair, Representative Lynn, I don't know if those are traded on public markets.
Yeah. Just and one quick follow-up. And I understand, you know, there are many social issues, and all of us have our own favorite social issues. But what we're talking about here is not a social issue, which many people can disagree on, but it's a issue of national security.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. And we'll hold this, and thank you for your testimony, and we'll get back. We'll see you next Tuesday. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.